And all your bodies, all the ones you, you know, keep in the basement or wherever. We don't judge. No, that's not true. We do judge. We totally judge.
yeah, we're just excellent at that.
Welcome to another episode of Real Monsters. I'm S.K. Barrett, and I'm joined, as always, by the fabulous Wes Hobrick.
Hello, hello, hello. Yeah, wherever you may have those bodies, from sea to shining sea, in your basement, in your cooler, wherever, we don't judge.
No, we leave that to the police and the court systems.
Yep.
We have a very famous summertime killer. I mean, he wasn't strictly summertime, but people mentally associate him with summer and death.
That they definitely do.
And first, though, we have dun-dun-dun, This Week in Crime History.
July 25th, 2004. Brian Blackwell butchers both his parents and goes on a 30,000-pound spending spree for his girlfriend. I had never heard of him before, but evidently it was rather big news. July 25th, 2004.
No, never heard of it.
Me neither until then. Evidently it was pretty big news in the UK at the time, though. July 26th, 1984. Ed Gein dies of congestive heart failure from cancer.
Wow. In prison, obviously.
Yeah, well, hospital, yeah. Prison. July 27th, 1996. Ivan Milat, Australia's backpack killer.
Yes.
Convicted of 7 murders.
He's definitely on the list for a show.
Yeah, absolutely. Didn't they do a fictionalized movie about him, too? I think it was called Wolf Creek. I might have to look that up.
Yeah, I believe so. He's definitely been in some of these crime anthology TV shows. He's gotten mentions there for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, awful lot of room to hide bodies and do other assorted things in the outback.
Aircraft carriers. You can hide out there.
Yeah. July 28th, 1999, a $907 million civil suit is brought against spiritual guru Ira Einhorn by the family of his murdered girlfriend Helen Maddox, whom he beat to death.
Whoa.
Apparently, they were worried that he was going to find ways to profit off of that crime.
Oh, like what? Like a book deal or something like that?
Yeah, which, oddly enough, we'll be getting into that. That whole concept has a lot to do with who we're talking about tonight, too.
Oh, really? I can't wait to hear that part.
And in fact, speaking of him, July 29th, 1976, the Son of Sam kills his first.
Whoa.
Yep. We will be getting to that. So there's actually quite a few interesting ones this week. July 30th, 1975, labor leader Jimmy Hoffa disappears.
Yeah.
Never found again, of course.
Well, that's what he, you know, wanted people to think. I mean, he just went home to whatever planet in the Andromeda galaxy he came from.
Might have. Damn aliens sending Marxists to sew up Discord on Earth.
Right.
200 FBI agents on that case at one time. Wow.
Not so much as a clue.
Nope. Nothing. But July 31, 1910, U.S. murderer, I think he was a doctor, Dr. Crippen, arrested by Scotland Yard. This guy poisoned and then shot his wife when she found him with another man and then ran away with his mistress. Wow. So.
Dick.
Yeah. you know, the last big one, actually, August 1, on this day in 1966, Charles Whitman is killed after killing 16 from the bell tower of Texas A&M.
Texas A&M bell tower. Yeah.
Yep.
That has actually become a bit of an idiom, you know, talking about, clock tower.
A clock tower, not a bell tower.
Yeah.
My apologies, sir.
Well, there might have been bells up there, too. But, yeah.
Very true. Yeah, I'm not sure. But, yeah, he was interesting, too, for the reason that he ultimately killed. Having the tumor in his frontal lobe.
Oh, I don't remember hearing about that.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, before he went and he did all that, he likely knew he was going to die. He left a note saying to look at my brain after all this, and then he had been complaining of, I guess you could call it vague head pains, vague headaches up until then.
Yeah.
And come to find out, you know, he has a tumor in his frontal lobe.
Damn.
I have a suspicion that they would have found something close to the same with the guy who shot up the concert in Las Vegas.
Oh.
But.
Do they not look at the brain?
They still.
Oh,
no, with that guy, he took a bullet to the head, so there's no way they could have.
Kind of destroyed the evidence. It.
Yep. Yep, and they still haven't found anything even remotely approaching a motive in that. So. But that's actually all I had this week for that.
Alrighty. So. Yet another case of, what the fuck, 70s?
Yeah. What the fuck, New York in this case, too.
Yeah.
David Berkowitz.
David Berkowitz, son of Sam.
Son of Sam, also known as the .44 caliber killer. It was before he got that Son of Sam moniker. And
which
known
he gave
as
himself.
Such. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, with letters that he wrote to the newspapers, but. Yeah, known as the .44 caliber killer because of the pistol he would carry. Interestingly, you know why he carried it in a paper bag?
He couldn't afford a holster?
That's actually remarkably close. The quote that I found one from him was, "I don't believe in holsters." Whatever that means, but
it's like saying you don't believe in hammers.
Yeah, basically. I don't believe in holsters. Yeah. You know, there's an awful lot of just flat out misremembered stuff that exists around this guy too, I've found. And it even afflicted the police.
Yeah.
Between his slayings as the 44 caliber killer, and then when they were able later to fill in some of those holes that they had. Now, did you know that he did not kill for their hair?
I don't know that I ever thought that that was the case. My misremembery on him, which I freely admit to, is I thought he was after lovers in Cars. But that's not at all the case.
Yeah. I mean, he went after a lot of lovers, but yeah, that wasn't his sole.
Like the first ones were two girls, and then there was two other guys, and there's no evidence that any of them were, you know, making out in their cars.
And it was essentially random. And I think a lot of it had to do with the hysteria that it caused at the time, too. Because it did go around because he was only killing dark-haired women for the first few of them. That's who he's targeting. But then, lo and behold, he kills a blonde. So, you know, the women don't know what to do from there. And they would, you know, across the city, there'd be thousands of them changing their hair color and, let's say, cutting their long hair down to short in an effort to avoid this guy.
And then one of the victims was just walking on the street, not in a car at all. So then there's that.
Yep. Absolutely.
So he was pretty good at mixing things, confusing the police and confusing the profile.
Yeah.
I mean, not great like Lucas, but, okay. He did okay at that. Misdirection and changing things up a little bit. But again, that probably just being random, not really trying to... confuse the cops, would you say?
I would definitely agree with that. Because, in fact, that is close to what he told them when they first caught him and, you know, were peppering him with questions about the crimes. But, yeah, the 44 caliber killer, born, actually, Richard David Falco, not David Berkowitz. As a name. In 1953, his mother had been married to a Tony Falco, and he just sort of took her name. Let's see. She later began a relationship with the married Joe Kleinman after having a child with Falco, and that was his sister or his half-sister is that other child. When Kleinman found out she was pregnant, again by Falco, he pressured her to give the baby up for adoption. That's, you know, ultimately what happened there with David. And I'm not sure how his name got switched around either, from Richard David to David Richard.
So according to Murderpedia, that was done as part of the adoption. Does it explain why? It doesn't explain why, but that was during the adoption that the name was, the first and middle names were swapped.
Probably just something like a paperwork snafu then, maybe.
Quite possibly.
Not sure. But yeah, a few days after birth, you know, he was adopted by a middle-aged couple, Nathan and Pearl Berkowitz, who lived in the Bronx. And Nathan, much of his time was spent at his hardware store that he owned. So he was never really close with Richard David, David Richard, whatever we want to call him, DR. My notes, I kept writing SOS, so you could just call him that, too. But, you know, he was never close with his adopted son, and he also quite often would tell him that the adoption was a mistake.
Oh, thanks, Dad.
Yeah. Kind of a jackass. But Pearl, his adopted mother, was very close with the boy. And, you know, kind of attendant with that, I would assume when you're the mother of a mischievous boy, she would let him get away with things that he probably shouldn't have. You know, around the neighborhood and what have you.
Oh, she was one of those.
Yeah, permissive in that regard.
Yeah. I can't recall a case of ever hearing about that kind of a mother where the kids turned out great.
Yeah, this is true. I can't say I've heard of that either. But he was, you know, a big kid too, and he would often use his size to bully a lot of the other kids. Let's see, he did not take at all really to academics. He was horrible at school. Missed class, but not stupid.
He had an above average IQ, right?
Yes. Yeah, not stupid, but not academically inclined, I guess you could say.
That, you know, that often is a, not always lethal, but at least a, you know, problematic combination. To be smart and not studious and, you know, looking for easy ways, which you can find better when you're smart.
Yeah, this is true.
That's a... and then you have an indulgent mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is a problematic combination. Often, anyway. But, yeah, he would often miss class from, no real surprise, truancy, but also feigned illnesses. So he could stay home. You know, another thing I found interesting that is on his early personal history.
Yeah.
He had a head injury from a car accident at age 7.
Oh, so there we find this again.
Yep.
Yep. So we've discussed this before. In one of my books on serial killers, there's often one of the early, it's not a trait, but it's a common thread that you often find among serial killers is head trauma.
Yep.
And
oh, most definitely.
Among, you know, there are obviously other factors, but it's a surprisingly frequent occurrence among serial killers.
It really is. And to clarify a bit here with the level of head trauma we're talking about, the other effects of it, the other long-term effects, were unclear. So there wasn't anything like a neurologic deficit or anything of that nature.
Or an obvious personality change.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, nothing like that. But, you know, I would wonder how much of something like that they would be looking for in a 7-year-old.
Yeah, that's true, because you're still developing as a person. You haven't even begun to really separate yourself as an individual yet.
Yeah, which I would say also applies to something else that started to manifest around this time, and that was his pyromania.
Ah.
yeah, another part of that McDonald triad.
Yep.
Yeah, he began burning bugs with magnifying glasses and starting neighborhood fires.
Okay, burning bugs, that's just curiosity when you're a kid. If you're burning your neighbor's house, that's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, the source that I saw it, beyond those two, it just said starting neighborhood fires, which is kind of, you know, nonspecific, but something was there. When David was 14, his adopted mother died. That was after a 2-year bout with breast cancer. That was, again, really the only person that he was close with. You know, no friends or anything else to speak of. And his adopted dad was a bit of an asshole. So after that, he started slowly slipping into a dark depression. And when his stepdad, remarries, his new stepmother was pretty well as distant or more distant than her new husband. Mm. But they end up moving to Boynton Beach, Florida, near Miami. And that was when his isolation became even more pronounced.
How old was he when his father remarried?
He would have been 15, 16
and then they,
at max.
And then they moved him to fucking Florida?
Yeah. Yeah. From New York to Florida.
Yeah, that's going to make anybody crazy.
Well, this is true, probably. But yeah, it was down there in Boynton Beach where his fantasy life sort of really started up into higher gear, too. And ultimately, he would join the army to get away from both his stepdad and his stepmom now. That was in 1971, where he was shipped to Korea.
Mm.
And he seemed to do pretty well in the structure of the military.
By the
way, it was also
just a little historical note from my memory. The draft was still in effect. At least the
this is true.
Yes, no, it was. Yeah, 71. The draft was still in effect. So although he very likely did sign up to get away from dad and the evil stepmother, he might also have just been trying to stay ahead of the draft and do it more on his own terms.
True. Was it about 71 when they were sort of dialing Vietnam back? That's kind of weird that they would send him to Korea.
Well, Korea was still... things were kind of trending down because it really ended in 72.
Oh, okay. I was thinking 73 for some weird reason
Maybe 72 was the Tet Offensive.
And that might have been. I could have to look that up.
Which
I'm curious now.
Speaking of misremembering, we totally won that, but the media played it up as a big loss.
You mean the war or the Tet Offensive? Okay.
Militarily, it was devastating for the North Koreans, but politically, it was a win.
The Tet Offensive, January 30, 1968,
to
September 23rd.
What?
Yeah.
I totally had that
wrong. That's
what
it's saying here. Yeah, to September 23rd, 68.
68, Jesus.
Hmm. Wow. I guess they must have been dialing Vietnam back in 71, though.
Well, they still needed people to rotate into Korea. Vietnam or no Vietnam. And maybe he was, not good enough, so to speak, for a frontline soldier.
Yeah, that could be. I didn't take a deep dive into his military record, but... Yeah, they trained him as a marksman, and he was honorably discharged in 1974. And he took the money that he got from there, moved back to New York City, and got a Bronx apartment and started taking classes at Bronx Community College.
Wow.
And it was there that he was remembered as both weird and off.
No, really?
And he worked a number of odd jobs too, including mailman, which is the job that he had when they caught him in 77. security guard, and he was even a volunteer cop in New York City. Volunteer police officer. So.
But not. Yeah, so this is where his inability to study really hurt him. And in this sense, now, even if he had been able to pass the whatever the test is to become a policeman in New York City, he still could have turned into a killer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Although it may have been harder to convict him, because he may have been able to hide it under, you know, his, you know, carrying out his duties.
Yeah. Well, and not to mention, you do kind of get that thin blue line.
Right.
You know, stepping in to try to protect their own, too.
Yeah. But, and, you know, and there's a good chance he would have been corrupt either way, because he had that tendency to to petty crimes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind of that. When he moved to Yonkers, New York, he was often on the local police radar for instigating and escalating petty disputes with his neighbors. So that's another thing that would come back to bite him in the ass, too.
Not the good neighbor type.
No, not at all. But it was also around that time when he met his birth mother and his sister. His, you know, birth sister.
Oh, really?
Yep. And apparently when he found out about his adoption around this time, he went nuts. And he cut both of those women out of his life.
He didn't know? Completely. Wait a minute. How could he not know about his adoption when his dad, his, you know, adoptive father was rubbing it in his face all the time?
Yeah. You know, I am not totally sure of that. Or maybe it was when he found out about the circumstances surrounding that.
Maybe.
Because those were... One of the main reasons that he was adopted there was because the Kleinman guy that I had mentioned didn't want her keeping that kid.
He was married. Right.
Yeah, Kleinman was married. But he didn't want his mistress keeping that kid. His mistress being Berkowitz's birth mother. So she ultimately got rid of him. That might have been what that was all about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was around that time as well that his pyromania resurfaced. And he starts, get this, about 1,500 fires around New York City from 74 to 77.
That's like every fucking day.
Yep.
That's almost...
Yeah,
that's more than one a day over 3 years.
Yep. And that's also the time when he was killing people in large part.
Yeah. Although, I
15
think...
15 freaking hundred.
He never thought of combining those two hobbies?
You know, apparently not. I don't think he did. But the interesting thing as well with those fires was that he managed to keep a journal recording all that too, with a lot of detail. Yeah. Yep. Like, oh, I fucked myself with a rusty nail on that. Damn.
Yikes.
But during the arsons, he had a label that he appropriated to himself, the Phantom of the Bronx. Like, ooh, that's so intimidating.
Ooh.
The Phantom of the Bronx. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because so much of that, I think, is lack of control. You know, He thinks he has control over damn near anything. He's just, he can't control anything. So what's he do? He goes and he does something that he can control, which is a fire.
Well, you can control when it starts. I mean,
this is true.
Fire is, you know, firefighters talk about fire as if it's a creature. Like it has a mind and a will of its own. So, yeah, you can control how and where and when you start one, but how it ends, you don't really control that.
Definitely.
But maybe that was enough.
Hey, let's hope, but then you also have to consider that he was putting bullets in people's heads, and evidently that wasn't relieving enough of the tension either. You know, it almost makes you wonder if he would have killed another way if maybe he didn't have to light that many fires.
You know,
because it's just, it's almost more clinical killing the way that he did versus, killing with a knife or strangling, you know, the way that a Bundy would kill.
Right.
Or even BTK. You know, there's a degree of being removed when it's a gunshot, in my view. But
a little bit. I mean, he did get pretty close to him, though.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely did.
He wasn't up in a clock tower. He was arm's length.
Yeah, I mean, this is true. Maybe there isn't much of a difference there, but you're also not twisting it into him.
Right. There is a degree of remove, but it's not as big as, you know, a sniper, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, that physical distance is way shortened, but yeah, in 1975, he picked up a copy of Anton LaVey's The Satanic Bible. And it was around this time that supposedly he started becoming convinced that he was being controlled by evil spirits. That's another thing that we will be getting into here. What's bullshit with this guy and what's not?
And was he really taking orders from the neighbor's dog?
Yep. And that bullshit, it's lasting quite a while, but yeah. And it just showing a bit of his state of mind around that time, though. In November 1975, he wrote a letter to his dad. And one of the quotes from that was, "It's dark now." Around Christmas that year, he also took a hunting knife and basically roamed around for a victim. And he did actually stab two women.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they both survive that?
You know, that is something I would have to check again, because I'm kind of doubting I wrote here.
Hold on. I'll look it up.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be great. Yes, Becky,
late
did blame the neighbor's dog. Maybe they did both die. And it's just treated separately.
One was hospitalized.
Oh, okay.
So, but it doesn't say the other one died.
I wonder if he just learned from that or what, and he wanted to do it more cleanly. Maybe he just didn't have the constitution, as it were, to stab somebody either.
Yeah, it's definitely would be considered easier, you know, to pull a trigger from 3 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
Versus stabbing.
Yep. Definitely. Let's see. Yeah, in Yonkers, you know, he had a lot of neighbors, and one of them had a German Shepherd, which barked incessantly. Getting a bit into Becky's question there. Berkowitz would, of course, later claim that its barks were commands to kill women. Claimed he was suicidal from it, too. But, you know, what sucked about that? When he moved to a new apartment in Yonkers, he was unable to get away from a neighbor with a loud barking dog. So they were bugging him there, too.
Clearly, the dogs were not telling them to kill the dogs.
Yeah. Yep. But it was that second apartment where he was neighbors to Sam Carr, who will also be very important in this. But, yeah, his run-ins, in fact, with Carr. I didn't know this part of it, but he tried to kill that dog with a Molotov cocktail.
What?
Before he shot it. Yeah, a Molotov cocktail. Evidently, it survived that part. But poor thing, couldn't survive David Berkowitz. And ultimately, he was convinced, he said, that Sam was the devil. And he knew, after those knives, that he needed a new way of killing that was, in his words, superior to knife attack.
Well, 44 caliber revolver definitely qualifies as superior.
Yeah. And this is true, although a 44 revolver wasn't his only gun either. He actually had a pretty big arsenal of assault rifles, pistols.
It's interesting. All right, so where are we in the chronology so far?
I don't want to
bring up my point too soon.
I was down to, in fact, that arsenal was built up by June 76. So he'd be about a month away from the first kill that he made,
which was in July 76, July 29.
July 29, yep. 1976.
Wow. 43 years ago. This week.
This is July 29th, so what, 3 days ago?
Yeah. So he shoots Jody Valenti and Donna Lauria, and they were sitting inside a parked car on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Lauria.
Sorry, I was just...
It was okay.
I lost my spot. That's why I was still looking for it.
No problem. Lauria was killed, but Valenti survived.
Wounded in the left thigh, Jody Valenti.
Okay, so this guy was a army marksman.
Yeah.
And yet he's not that good of a shot with a handgun.
No, he really isn't. And he really isn't, but yeah, Donna Lauria, 18, of Westchester Heights in the Bronx. Shot and killed about 1 a.m. on July 29th, 1976, while sitting in that parked car. Jody Valenti was 19, of Hutchinson River Parkway, wounded in the left thigh as she sat in the car with Miss Lauria.
And this really didn't get much attention at the time because there was no history yet.
Yeah, because it's a shooting in the Bronx.
Right.
I mean, This was about the same time, if I'm not mistaken, that they were having real crime problems in New York City.
Oh, yes. Serious crime problems.
Yep. So I can't imagine it really would get all that much attention, but maybe not. That was July 29. I'm still looking through my notes here. You know, there was quite a few of these. It almost makes me wonder how they got the degree of certainty that they ultimately had with a lot of these scenes. For instance, another thing that was sort of accepted wisdom with Son of Sam was that he would always, for whatever reason, fire four shots. And there's five shots in that .44 revolver that he was shooting them out of. But if I'm not mistaken, that first scene was another one where he wouldn't do that, where he actually emptied the revolver on them.
Jesus, really?
It was one of a couple, I think, where he emptied the revolver. But again, the cops of the time, that was one thing that they thought, well, you would only fire four, but come to find out when they finally do, get David Berkowitz in custody, he said, no, that's not right. You know, I would fire five at a few of them.
Hmm.
But yeah, you had that scene.
And by the way, the reason why it only had five rounds is because it's a fucking 44 caliber. It couldn't fit six like you could with a 38.
Oh, I imagine. And that's a big gun. That's a hand cannon, a 44. In fact, that was the exact gun that Dirty Harry used.
Yeah. And then the line from 44. The movie is, did I fire five or did I fire six? Well, Harry, you only had five to begin with.
Yep. Yep. I mean, that is a big gun, but... It is. The second attack was on October 23rd. So you had about,
That's a long 2 months? Cooling off.
It is. I wonder if he was setting fires in between them that helped him to stay calmer longer, maybe.
That's 3 months.
Yep. But yeah, that second scene, Carl DeNaro, age 20, wounded in the head as he sat in a parked car with Rosemary Keenan on 160th Street in Flushing, Queens. The injury required doctors to place a steel plate in his skull, and Miss Keenan was uninjured. Yeah, that is just utterly amazing.
My report says that she died.
Keenan?
Yeah.
Really? Do you happen to have a day that it says?
October 23rd, 76.
October 23rd. That is strange. Because the one that I just read that out of is my source from the New York Times on this. That book, the New York Times Book of Crime, which has just their verbatim reporting in it.
I think
the source that said?
Murderpedia.
Oh.
And I think they're wrong. I think they're totally wrong. Cause...
I think so, too. I do use them occasionally, but yeah, I think you're right. They're wrong on this. But it is still nevertheless quite amazing the amount of people who took a bullet in their head but survived.
Yeah, so here's a report from the New York Post that says she was not hit.
Okay. Yeah, that would be close to the Times
count.
So Perfect. Oh, yeah, that's another thing that I did do for anybody who's listening to this. If you head over to our Facebook page, facebook.com/realmonsters, or is it Real Monsters Podcast? I always get that wrong. Becky, help.
It's just Real Monsters.
Okay, thank you. Yes, if you head over to our Facebook page, facebook.com/realmonsters, I have a collection of headlines from the time that I put up in there to get a closer look at for anybody who's interested, and also a collection of Son of Sam's letters in two separate posts.
Yeah, very interesting reading.
Yeah, the third attack, there wasn't much of a space in between that and the second at all. About 1 month and 4 days. So you have Joanne Lamino, age 18, of Belrose, Queens, was shot in the back of the head at 12:40 a.m. on November 27th, 1976, while sitting on the porch of her home with a friend. And she came away from that paralyzed from the waist down. And her friend, Donna DiMazzi, 17, of Floral Park, Queens, shot through the neck.
Jesus.
And I don't have whether she survived or not.
I'll look it up.
But let's see, that's two so far who survived a head wound. I should have wrote down that number, damn it. Yeah.
Oh, also mentioned in this same New York Post article. I'll have this momentarily. It doesn't mention that she died, so.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of weird they wouldn't mention anything at all with her, though, with how she ended up.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's see. Yeah, it was also around this time that he quit his security guard job to drive a cab. Berkowitz did. And ultimately, he quit that to install HVAC.
That would be a better job, probably.
Yeah, I would think so. Not sure what it paid back then.
Had to be better than the cabbie.
Yeah. Oh, that wasn't until scene five. Okay. So then we had it around January 30th. This is his first attack in 1977, Christine Freund, 26, of Ridgewood, Queens, shot to death at 12:30 a.m. as she sat in a parked car near the Long Island Railroad Station, Forest Hills, Queens. With her and unhurt was John Deal, age 30. And this next attack was...
here we go again. He's got a fucking cannon in his lunch sack, basically. But still, It's a .44 caliber with five rounds in it. He shoots at two people, and so far, only one time has he killed both of the victims.
And you would think so, especially with the back of the head, because there's more of a chance you're going to hit the brainstem back there. I mean, with the, like, so, you said, with the .44, it's big.
Yeah, you just got to get close.
Dang.
It's just, yeah, he's not a good shot.
Not in the least.
Now, when it comes to real shooting, maybe he's okay at a range.
Well,
I mean,
I'm not sure on that.
he was obviously good enough to get a marksman badge in the Army.
Yeah.
But I don't know that that's a real, it's not like top honors or anything. It just means you're proficient.
Yeah, this is true. But yeah, this next attack is where the Son of Sam moniker comes into play. That was Virginia Voskerichian, I think is how you say that. Voskerichian. 19 of Forest Hills, Queens. Shot to death at about 7:30 p.m. last March 8th, as she walked on Dartmouth Street on her way home from college. She was slain a half block from where Miss Freund, in the attack that directly preceded hers, was killed 5 weeks earlier. But Berkowitz, he left a letter at that scene, which
What?
said, attack number five,
Yeah.
he left a letter at that scene which said, quote, "I am the Son of Sam. I am a monster. I am on a different wavelength than everybody else. Programmed to kill. To stop me, you must kill me. I am the monster. Beelzebub. The chubby," and he meant to say behemoth, but he spelt it B-E-H-E dash M-O-U-T-H.
Oh, the Son of Sam letter. Let me see. I have this one. Which one is it?
Yeah, I can't remember if I put that one in with the letters or not. I know that I put the newspaper ones in.
Yeah,
And the Breslin letter, too. I know I put that one in there.
I remember seeing the one where it said, I am, where he called himself Son of Sam.
Oh, yeah, and he also said in it, "I love to hunt. Prowling the streets for tasty meat." This is how he spelt it again. Weeman, Weemon, of Queens are prettiest of all.
Yeah, damn it, I had this one set up.
You know, that might be part of where they got the hair thing from. He had, again, literally thousands of women throughout the five boroughs of New York City who were dark-haired, because most of the women up to now were dark-haired and were, changing to red or blonde and
Yeah.
Cutting that long dark hair. But then what happens when those surface characteristics of his victims are switched, when he starts looking for, like a blonde and kills a blonde? Just a part of the hysteria throughout all this.
I am, damn it, I am not
Can't find
finding,
it.
I'm not finding that goddamn letter.
No worries. We got the quote from it. So. But yeah, it's so much of the rest of that hysteria. We were talking a bit before we got on air of a couple of instances of that. Throughout all this, the NYPD is doing damn near everything it can to
Yeah.
beef up patrols in these areas. In Queens, the Bronx, and Brooklyn is how they, the different victims, the different attacks shook out. You had four of them in Queens, then you had three in the Bronx and one in Brooklyn. But to show people the level that people were freaking out during this. There was one story about a burglar in Brooklyn who was caught with a larger caliber handgun. And a mob of people literally took him out in the street and beat him damn near to death. And then we're going to hang him from a makeshift noose around a traffic light. It took about a dozen NYPD officers to subdue them.
Wow.
But then I ran into another story with this about a guy who drove a yellow VW who was speeding, not even going all that fast through one of these neighborhoods, but was speeding. And they ended up somehow catching up to him, pulling him out of his car, and again, beating him nearly to death. All because they thought that the son of Sam drove a yellow bug, too.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. And, yeah, Gabriel Allen says in the chat, Bundy. Yep, Bundy drove a yellow bug as well.
Beige, actually.
Well, yeah, beige.
But this was the same time frame. I mean, Bundy was... Actually, he was in prison. In 77, he was in... that's when he escaped from Grand Junction during his trial there, but then was convicted. So he, in 77, he was in prison in Colorado. So these were contemporaries.
Absolutely. I would wonder how easy it would be to tell the difference between a beige-colored VW and a yellow one if it's just illuminated by, say, streetlights in New York City.
Yeah, well, it depends on how bright a yellow it is, right?
That's true. I didn't catch that part.
But if then again, you know, when people are, you know, wound up, they're gonna make mistakes and justify it. You know, like, I could very easily, you know, imagine people going, "It's not yellow," and the other guy goes, "Well, maybe the cops are wrong."
Yeah, this is true. Definitely. You know, and I wasn't able to find out what that source was, you know, that how these people would have known that he had a VW. So I didn't see that mentioned anywhere in any of the newspaper sources or anything.
Yeah.
But
it could have just been word of mouth.
True. Very true. Yeah, and then, you know, after that Attack 5, it's also when a lot more of the publicity of the murders in the Son of Sam started ramping up more so. And he did quite a lot, I think, to court that with his letters to the newspapers and then his letter to crime columnist Jimmy Breslin.
Right.
Who was, I think, at the Post at the time. I think we printed the letter, too, in the slideshow. But moving forward from that Attack 5... April 17 was attack number 6. It was Valentina Suriani, age 18, of Baychester, the Bronx, and Alexander Esau of West 46th Street. Both shot to death at 3 a.m. as they sat in a parked car on Hutchinson River Parkway near Miss Suriani's home.
Wow. Another parked car.
Yep. Then jumping ahead there, you had about 2 months again. He's pretty on schedule with that 2 months for most of these. Yeah. Judy Placido, age 17, of the Pelham Bay section of the Bronx, shot in the right temple, right shoulder, and back of the neck as she sat in a parked car with Salvatore Lupo at 3:20 a.m. on June 26, 1977, Bayside, Queens. Mr. Lupo was wounded in the right forearm.
Jesus.
Yep.
Again, he's a shitty shot. He's a terrible shot.
He really is.
Unless he's really only going for the primary and the second person in these cars are just collateral.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because when they catch him after attack number eight, well, yeah. I'll get into that in just a second. Let's look at number eight first. number eight, Robert Violante, age 20, of the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn, shot in the head at 2:50 a.m. on... Is that? Oh, August 1. 2:50 a.m. as he sat in a parked car with Stacy Moskowitz in a Lover's Lane area near Diker Beach Park in the Bath Beach section of Brooklyn. Mr. Violante was critically wounded. Ms. Moskowitz, age 20, of Flatbush section of Brooklyn, was shot once in the head and also was critically wounded.
And they both survived?
No, nope. She was critically wounded. Well, she died.
Okay. Critically doesn't Violante. Mean fatally.
Violante.
Is he the one that was blinded?
He was the one. Yeah. Let's bring that one up, in fact. He took one that ended up going through his left eye and basically shattering it.
Through the eye?
Yeah.
Jesus.
But he survived somehow. But Moskowitz did not. And she kind of went down ultimately as the most infamous, I guess you could say, of the ones who died by the hand of Son of Sam.
Wow.
But to answer Gabriel's question, did he have a girlfriend? No, he did not. And there was a rather interesting quote about that, which we also had in there.
Should we pull that up now?
Let's do it. In that quote, he more or less directly speaks to that. There it is at the top. The highlighted. I think that if I were to have a good, mature sexual relationship with a woman, I wouldn't have killed. If I would have been able to participate in many kinds of sex acts and in orgies, I wouldn't have killed. I would have been content and happy without destruction. Sex, I believe, is the answer, the way to happiness.
Obviously, he doesn't have much experience.
Nope. Not at all. You know, it's kind of interesting, though. If I actually believed that was the reason that he killed, it would make him an early example of an incel.
Yeah. You know, I agree with you. I think this is a red herring to a large extent. But interestingly, Bundy, even though he had girlfriends and long-term girlfriends, he also expressed a frustration with understanding how relationships work.
Mm-hmm. But now, and wasn't others, his others more as well, on that level, we... though?
Say again?
His wasn't just trolling and saying if I would have had sex, it would have been better, though.
No, because
me, that's different.
Because he did have sex. I mean, he had girlfriends, and
yeah.
So he wasn't frustrated. He wasn't sexually frustrated in that sense. He was socially frustrated with with women. He just really didn't get women at all. But he was somehow able to not kill his girlfriends.
Yeah, this is true.
Which is kind of strange when you think about it, about a guy
It
who
really is.
kidnaps and murders young women and then he has one at home.
Yep.
But we've seen this kind of sentiment. Shit, hold on. What's his name?
And which one?
Hold on, I'll get it. Kemper.
Oh, yeah.
He expressed some very similar sentiments.
Eddie did. Yeah, I had forgotten about Ed.
I have his quote somewhere. Oh, here it is. This is what Ed Kemper said. "You know, it all really goes back to my perceived inability to communicate socially, sexually. I was scared to death of failing male-female relationships, even sitting down to talk to a young lady. I wanted to communicate."
Definitely. Yeah, it's so interesting with people like Kemper and Bundy too. They were excellent communicators in so many regards. They just didn't feel themselves to be like that. No with self-esteem on that, but yeah, I mean, responding to Mr. Deadman where he says incel. Yeah, I would say the same thing if I actually believed that that's why Berkowitz killed, but I don't. And we'll get into that,
Especially
but
since he killed just as many guys, almost. I mean, he killed several young men too.
oh, absolutely.
So
And that
he.
goes back to again what I was saying about the things that the police were getting wrong that they didn't know they were getting wrong.
Yeah.
One of those was, in fact, that last kill where Stacy Moskowitz was killed and Robert Violante was injured. There
Yeah.
was actually a guy, a witness, sitting there who saw basically the whole thing happen
Yeah.
as it was happening. And it turns out that Berkowitz actually had his sights set on this guy in the other car and his girlfriend.
The guy who
But
turned out being a witness?
yes, the witness. But what
What?
evidently happened was this guy moved his car to where it made it harder for Berkowitz to get at it.
Oh.
So he sort of switched it up, real fast like that and went after them instead. So, but he did also say when the cops were grilling him on, again, literally peppering him with everything they can think of to ask, that his main target was always the woman in any of that. So, yeah, you
Interesting.
had that and the other big thing that he was kind of driving home with that was that there really wasn't a whole lot of organization with the ones that he was
No.
going after. He
Seemed
was not going
pretty random.
after, I agree, and that's exactly what he said they were, but evidently the cops needed that pointed out to them that he was just randomly targeting. It had nothing to do with hair color or, length or anything like that.
Right.
Even though people made a whole huge case of that. But
But Berkowitz made a critical mistake on the last shooting, didn't he?
I'm trying to, what do you mean
He got a
with that
parking
one?
ticket.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yeah, that absolutely was a critical mistake.
And not just a parking ticket, but somebody saw him taking the ticket off of his car before driving away, which led this witness to think that maybe this guy saw something.
It's interesting. I hadn't read that part.
That was the initial impetus was that, oh my God, this guy was down there when this shooting took place. Maybe he saw something.
Interesting. You know, I think they ultimately would have gotten to him even without that witness there. Because the other thing that they did with those parking tickets was they literally pulled all the names in who were ticketed around that time in that area. Mm. Did a whole, you know, dragnet with it. So sometime he would have gotten on their radar with that. But, yeah, ultimately when he went to trial, he didn't go to trial. It was all about pleading guilty.
So he just pled out and had no trial.
Yep. I think though, and this is getting into his sort of quintessential essence as a bullshit artist.
Yeah.
It was around he concocted the whole idea of the dog around this time when they caught him, in my opinion.
As a cover, as a rationalization. I mean, it's not like it was to, you know, plead in, you know, insanity, because he just confessed and you know, he pled guilty, so there was no trial. There was, I don't know what he would have, but at the same time, he just liked making up bullshit stories.
He really did. He does fit to a T the whole idea of compulsive liar when you look at him. I think he wanted it in his back pocket almost, if he had to have an insanity defense. Maybe he figured that it just wouldn't have played, and that's why he decided to take the guilty plea. I don't know.
I would say, you know, the pathological liar aspect kind of makes some sense, because if you've ever, you know, been around one for real, which I have, they lie about shit that doesn't matter.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Most definitely.
You know, it's not like there is, you know, a normal, let's say, liar, you know, they lie because, you know, they want to look better or stay out of trouble or something like that, some personal benefit. But a pathological liar will lie about shit that just is irrelevant to anybody.
Yeah. That will make their life harder when it's found out.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. But yeah, they got that far with it. And, you know, he's been incarcerated ever since, but this isn't where the story ends either. Not too long after that, he began his second line of bullshit, as it were. Satanic cult.
Yeah, before we do that, I just wanted to make one more point. And that is, we have seen several cases already where these monsters are caught through by chance almost, and not through rigorous detective work. Ridgway was definitely caught through, you know, massive amounts of detective work. Bundy was caught because he's a shitty driver.
Yeah.
Berkowitz was caught because he parked by a fire hydrant. And, you know, there are other cases like this. It's fascinating how often, surprisingly often, these guys are brought down by stupid mistakes like that.
And if they're honest, they will tell you that it's not the daring and dogged police work that they rely on a mistake happening and them catching it.
Yeah.
And an honest detective will tell you that, definitely.
Right. I mean, they're still going to do their put in their work, and they're going to try and solve it, but they know how often that happens.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right. So, satanic cults.
Yeah, he started later on adopting this whole idea of, oh, I was the victim of a satanic cult, that I was recruited into them, and that they were, in essence, trying to start a apocalyptic war to bring civilization down. Ooh. And he actually, yeah, it's kind of the Manson
and him,
excuse.
And him shooting people sitting in cars is how that's going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, I know. But, he started saying that in, I think it was the 80s, around the time of the Satanic Panic when all that started. And he actually pointed out a specific cult with that. And that was the Process Church of the Final Judgment, which was a started like a... as an offshoot of Scientology, actually.
Oh, no kidding. Yep. It sounds like a cult of prison guards.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, yeah, he tried to say that, oh, yeah, I just sort of became their trigger man. And the other thing that got me with that is he said he was possessed. He said that after he picked up the Satanic Bible, he was possessed by evil. Oh. But you know the big problem with that?
Pick one.
A huge, huge one. The Satanic Bible is the religious text of an atheistic religion. Oops. Atheistic Satanists. Satanists that don't believe in God or a devil.
So what is Satan to them?
He's essentially just a symbol to them.
Oh, okay.
Of not rebellion, of free thinking.
Not an
and
actual
all of that.
Deity?
No, not an actual deity at all.
Oopsie.
But, yeah. Like, oh yeah, I was possessed by an atheistic book. But yeah, that's when you get into, you know, the atheistic Satanism as opposed to deistic Satanism, which is,
I didn't even
know
that was
dyed in the wool. Yeah, dyed in the wool devil worship is theistic Satanism. But the Satanic Temple, the group that you hear an awful lot about with challenging laws that are... that penalize Satanists and challenging them on religious grounds.
Yeah.
They make quite a lot of noise about that, including like their displaying their statue of Baphomet at different state capitals of the Baphomet the Goat.
Oh, okay.
Those people are actually atheistic Satanists.
Ah.
But you know, they have some interesting tenets too. I'll go ahead and post them in the chat. But it's all about, like, tenet one, one should strive to act with compassion and empathy toward all creatures in accordance with reason. Tenet two, the struggle for justice is an ongoing and necessary pursuit that should prevail over laws and institutions. Tenet three, one's body is inviolable, subject to one's own will alone. Tenet four, the freedoms of others should be respected, including the freedom to offend. To willfully and unjustly encroach upon the freedoms of another is to forego one's own. Beliefs should conform to one's best scientific understanding of the world. One should take care never to distort scientific fact to fit one's beliefs. People are fallible. If one makes a mistake, one should do one's best to rectify it and resolve any harm that might have been caused. And the last tenet, every tenet is a guiding principle designed to inspire nobility in action and thought. The spirit of compassion, wisdom, and justice should always prevail over the written or spoken word. So yeah, apparently the religious book of those people is what possessed our little buddy Dave. So yeah,
again, he wasn't a great student.
No. I mean, it was just another bullshit lie. And then you also have around that time he became a born again Christian and, you know, had his Paul on the road to Damascus moment, supposedly, which I think is yet another line of bullshit from him.
Right.
In my opinion.
Well, you can get whatever kind of drugs you want in prison if you're willing to pay for it.
This is true.
And hallucinogens might be a really nice way to pass the time inside. I don't know.
This is true. That was kind of the tack that Bundy took later on death row.
He sure did. He had help.
He did.
He had a girlfriend smuggling shit in her hoo-ha.
Yep. Wow. Of course, I'm still surprised they didn't put him in like a Supermax facility after escape number two.
I don't know if they had those yet.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know the history, but I don't recall ever hearing about that kind of a prison. I mean, other than like Alcatraz was as close as we had.
Interesting. I would have to ask my second cousin. Actually, was a prison guard for years at the prison up here, and he also in the state of Illinois would ride around with I forget what they called him exactly, but it was a squad, and their only directive was to go around to different prisons and put down riots within them. Once one would start. So he did that, too.
Was that Zoot Suit Riot?
Throwback bottle of beer.
That's a nasty business, putting down prison riots. Interestingly, when I was a senior in high school in Denver, we had arranged a tour of the men's maximum security prison in Canyon City as a field trip. And when we arrived, it was on lockdown because of a riot.
Dang.
And it was, it was one of these old Shawshank looking places, you know, just ominous stone building, like 3-4 stories, something like that.
Sheesh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we ended up going to the women's prison instead. That was much better.
There you go. I wonder if that was before they built the one in... or no, that's a federal prison. I was thinking of the one in Florence, Colorado.
Yeah, that probably came later.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if that old place is closed down now.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder.
Definitely old school prison. But the women's prison was new and it was like a college dorm. They had individual rooms with doors and not bars. And, and they had TVs and books and all kinds of stuff inside their rooms.
Wow.
And that was not minimum security because our tour guide was in for murder.
Dang. Yeah. That'll do it.
All right. We got any more Sam stuff?
I think we are done with that.
By the way, Spike Lee's movie Summer of Sam, I was very disappointed because there was almost no Sam in that movie at all, except
all about just the summer.
Yeah,
the the hysteria part of it, yeah. Yep. Yeah, and I guess our condolences to the Kennedy family.
Yeah.
It just hit the wire while we were talking. For those who are listening, the Kennedys lost their granddaughter, age 22, of an apparent overdose at their Hyannisport compound.
RFK's granddaughter.
Yep. Robert Kennedy's granddaughter, Sasha Hill.
That family is fucked up so many different ways.
Sad. Really is.
Well, I think we have, I think we've run out of Sam to talk about.
I think so. I think we beat him with a bloody pulp, but be sure to meet us back here same time next week, August 8th, for our Manson very, show.
Very special episode of Real Monsters. Yeah, the Manson episode, 50th anniversary.
On the
50th anniversary of the Tate killings. By the way, Wes, kudos on your excellent Sharon Tate column.
Thank you very much.
Be sure to post a link to that in the chat.
I was just going to do that as you were saying it. Had to bring it back up.
Very much worth watching, reading the article. And be here next week, God damn it. Watch our damn Manson show.
Absolutely. I can go ahead and post that again for us on Facebook, too.
Yeah.
It's taking me a little bit longer than I thought to dig it out because the site's acting a little weird. But yeah, we are going to be talking about Charles Manson himself.
Do I need to do everything for you tonight?
Apparently. Oh, here we go. I got it. Well, now, if it'll highlight. I hate Google Chrome. I swear, I need a new browser.
I just don't have any trouble with it.
It yet. I hope you don't, but I wouldn't be surprised if you do. Yeah, I just posted the URL for the column there.
Good.
For anybody who wants to check that out, shares would be appreciated too if you could. Just recently started writing for this site from my old gig as editor of a site that will be shutting down in December. So want to make sure they know that I am worth their time at this new one.
I have my letters of complaint all lined up, going out once a week, I think.
That's great.
That Wes, goddamn him. I'm not saying.
Yeah, shares would be much appreciated. Yeah, I posted it in the chat. Thought I might again.
Are you seeing
there
it?
There we go. I am under the chat.
Okay. Well, if you are, that's enough. Then it's there somewhere.
Somewhere.
And if you can't see it in the chat, you can see it on the Real Monsters page on Facebook.
On the Facebook. Yep.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in and watching our show. Good night.
Thank you all. Good night.